and welcome to Volume 45, Number 4 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 24th of January 2025. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined for this week by newsreader Andy. And in the news, a plethora of road closures are ahead, another pub is closing, and Caister's Pong is still getting up locals' noses. Had to come sometime. Plus, as we have him here, a bit of weird Norfolk from Andy. All this coming your way during the next hour or so, but first, a birthday. This week we send best wishes to Norman Harrison, celebrating next Friday the 30th. Have a great day, Norman. Another very busy week for news, so without further ado, over to Andy.
Hello, and I have this week's news in front of me. And there's rather a lot of it, and I'll apologise now for it. It's a little bit like the weather. It's an awful lot of gloomy stuff, I'm afraid. However, I'll start with one that's a bit more positive. A search for a missing man that's been called off. And the police search for a man who'd gone missing in Gorleston was called off on Wednesday after he was found. Police had launched a large-scale search operation for the man on Tuesday, which involved RNLI boats and a helicopter circling the coast. There'd also been an appeal launched for CCTV from local businesses that may have captured the man. The man had last been spotted outside of the amusements opposite the Ocean Room. He'd been spotted walking towards the end of Gorleston Pier at 10 a.m. on Tuesday morning. The search lasted well over 4 hours on Tuesday, with police being spotted looking for the man late into the afternoon. However, the search operation was called off on Wednesday, with the police confirming the man in his 60s had been found and thanking the public for any help. And next, theft in Gorleston. A tradesman was woken in the middle of the night to news his van had been broken into. The vehicle belongs to Sean Harvey, 36, who runs Handy Harvey's, a property and maintenance business in Gorleston. Mr. Harvey was asleep at around 11:30 p.m. on Sunday, January the 19th, when he was awoken to knocks on his front door. On his doorstep, a police officer told him his van, which was parked on Bells Road, had been broken into and power tools and batteries, worth approximately £670, were stolen. Mr. Harvey said, "The damage to the van made it unroadworthy. I had work booked in for Monday, but I had to cancel it. Letting customers down like that's absolutely awful." With replacing the tools and the broken van window, Mr. Harvey lost around £1,000 due to the theft. "It's a bit of a pain," he said. He has been running his business since October 2023. "I'm very happy with our local police officers for the service they provide. It's greatly appreciated. Hopefully we can help the community stop further things like this from happening." And another theft story, this time thefts of tools from cemeteries. Police have sent urgent crime prevention advice to parish councils across Norfolk after a spike in thefts from cemeteries. Tools and equipment have been stolen across the North Norfolk, Norwich and Greater Yarmouth areas in recent months. A Norfolk police spokesman said, "We have had a number of instances of thefts from outbuildings and sheds across Norfolk at cemeteries. The pattern is that outbuildings and storage facilities at cemeteries are targeted and tools and gardening equipment stolen. This can be from power tools to ride-on lawnmowers. Padlocks are cut with bolt cutters where secured. Community liaison officers across the force have issued guidance to parish councils on making buildings more secure. This includes ensuring padlocks are closed shackle, with hasps and staples bolted through the shed and hinges fixed by one-way screws or coach bolts. Ground anchors secured to a concrete base should be used to secure garden tools and mowers. A strong lockable box fitted to the floor can also be used to protect tools. Officers also recommend marking or etching property as a visual deterrent and ensuring CCTV and alarms are in working order. The next story is a swoop on a pub after suspected knife threat. A man has been arrested on suspicion of making threats with a knife inside a village pub. The incident happened at about 7:30 p.m. on Sunday, when witnesses said a man threatening people with a knife inside the King's Head pub in Yarmouth Road, Blowfield. Villagers have described seeing armed police swoop on the pub's car park as the man was believed to have wielded the weapon inside. Officers reportedly closed one half of the street heading towards the Premier convenience store following the incident. Six police cars attended the scene where a man was arrested on suspicion of a fray. He was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre where he was questioned. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Police added, "There were no reports of any injuries during the incident." And police have bailed a man for arson. Police have confirmed that a man who was arrested on suspicion of arson after a fire in a Hall's outbuilding has been released on bail. The fire service received reports of a blaze which ripped through an outbuilding at Winterton Hall and caused a loud bang as gas bottles exploded at around 6 a.m. last Friday, January the 17th. Firefighters arrived promptly and prevented it from spreading to homes, which were just a matter of metres away. However, the fire spread to a nearby burger van, igniting a gas canister and causing a massive explosion, according to neighbours. Norfolk Police, not long after the blaze was confirmed to have been put out, revealed that they had arrested a man in his 20s on suspicion of arson. Today, Norfolk Police has confirmed that the man has been released on bail until April the 16th. Fire engines from Great Yarmouth, Gorleston and Acle were called out and were at the scene for about 5 hours. Winterton Hall has rooms which are available to let on Airbnb and the owners live there. And a longer story, this one, it's relates to some things that perhaps you've heard on the national news as well. And it's an inquest into a contaminated blood victim. A Norfolk man has died 35 years after he received a contaminated blood transfusion following a car accident. Now the family of James Stalker will be looking for answers at an inquest into his death, due to be held next month. In his own words, written before he died at the age of 69, he described how he was left destitute as a result of the transfusion. He and his partner, Heidi Bolton, 62, of Ormsby St Michael, went on to lose their house, businesses and friends. Mr Stalker died having never received a penny in compensation, despite him and his family insisting they were eligible for an interim payment of £210,000 through the government's infected blood compensation scheme. More than 35 years ago, James Stalker suffered a horrific car accident in Belgium on a back road to Antwerp, close to the Dutch border. He was taken to hospital in the Netherlands, where an X-ray revealed swelling and 5 hairline fractures of the pelvis. Within several days, as soon as it was medically possible, a medical evacuation was arranged to take Mr. Stalker to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital. On arrival, no loss of blood had been detected and the pelvis was allowed to heal naturally with an ongoing physiotherapy for the next 2 months. All seemed to be going well until he attended his daughter's birth on July the 22nd, 1989, at the NNN, where he became distressed. Very quickly, he became seriously unwell and blood anemia was diagnosed, caused by internal seeping of blood associated with the pelvic break over a period of time. As his condition became life-threatening, the decision was made to give Mr. Stalker a blood transfusion on July 29th. He made a full recovery and was discharged. But in 1992, his world was turned upside down when he received a huge blow. Mr. Stalker worked for Nuclear Electric as a nuclear engineer on the reactor build of Sizewell B power station. Company policy was for staff to give blood at a mobile collection unit on site, which he did on August 20th, 1992. The next day, he was contacted by a senior researcher at Cambridge University Research Division of Transfusion Medicine and told his blood was contaminated with hepatitis C. In the months that followed, further extensive tests were undertaken, proving the hepatitis was in his blood and liver. He was given a year of interferon injection treatment for hepatitis, which he described as having dire mental and other side effects. This would begin a pattern of years of further tests and failed attempts at treatment. In December 2023, while waiting for an operation, Mr. Stalker, who previously owned an oil and gas business in Lowestoft, was told he was terminally ill and was referred back to his GP to die. Mr. Stalker, who was also known as Jeff, wrote in the document before he died that up until the transfusion, he was fit, did sports, never drank alcohol, and had a good social life. He added, "No amount of compensation from the government can cover the millions of pounds in lost revenue, the misery, debt, personal losses, damage to close family, stigma, pariah in the community, and mental and physical nerve damage. The NHS has given me a life of misery, where I went from a multi-million pound lifestyle to living on charity with the stigma and shame." His partner, Heidi, said she also has concerns about his treatment at the James Paget Hospital in Galston, which she says ultimately led to his sudden death at home in the Great Yarmouth area in September 2024. A full inquest into the circumstances surrounding his death is due to take place at Norfolk Coroner's Court at the end of February. More than 30,000 people were given infected blood or infected blood products between the 1970s and the early 1990s while undergoing NHS care. Some 3,000 people died as a result, and survivors are living with lifelong health implications. Many of those to receive contaminated blood were suffering from haemophilia and other disorders such as sickle cell. They became seriously ill after being given a new treatment called Factor 8 or Factor 9 from the mid-1970s onwards. The medication was at that time imported from the US, where it had been made from the pooled blood plasma of thousands of paid donors, including some in high-risk groups, such as prisoners. If a single donor was infected with a blood-borne virus, such as hepatitis or HIV, then the whole batch of medication could have been contaminated. An unknown number of UK patients were also exposed to hepatitis B or C through a blood transfusion after childbirth or hospital surgery, some as late as 1992. and another inquest story. A man who became unresponsive 15 minutes after taking the drug MDMA died before he could be saved, a court has heard. Glenn Henderson of Nelson Road Central in Great Yarmouth was seen taking the drug, which is also known as ecstasy, on September the 26th last year. Paramedics were called, but he later died at his home. An inquest into the 55-year-old's death was opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court this week by area coroner Samantha Gowan. She revealed that Mr. Henderson's daughter had identified her father and confirmed his date and place of birth as July the 10th, 1969, in Great Yarmouth. He was a retired engineer. Mrs. Goward added, he had been seen to put the tablets in his mouth and swallow them. Approximately 15 minutes later, he became unresponsive. CPR was commenced and an ambulance called, but he passed away at the scene. The medical cause of death was given as toxicity of MDMA. A full inquest to determine the official cause will take place in June, where reports will be read out from Norfolk Police and Mr. Henderson's GP and next of kin. And another drug-related story, and it's nitrous oxide canisters. The disposal of so-called laughing gas canisters is costing Norfolk taxpayers £15,000 a month, with illegal recreational use blamed for the huge sum. Norfolk County Council is spending an average of £5 per canister to treat and dispose of nitrous oxide canisters, with thousands being put in household rubbish or fly-tipped every month. The steel canisters cannot be dealt with in the same way as most waste, and Norfolk does not have the facilities to recycle them. It means the council has to pay more to dispose of them safely, including controlled depressurisation of the canisters, while larger ones have to be dealt with as hazardous waste. The canisters are used in the food industry, where nitrous oxide is used to create whipped cream, to carbonate drinks, and as a preservative. However, the extra costs of disposal are being blamed on people using the gas recreationally, despite possession for recreational use being made a criminal offence in November 2023. Council officers say, despite the ban, large numbers of canisters are turning up in household waste collections, or in some cases, have been dumped in farmers' fields. A county council spokeswoman said, most legitimate use of nitrous oxide is by the catering industry and therefore is not expected to come through Norfolk Council's household services, which include curbside collections and recycling centres. Unfortunately, councils continue to bear the cost of managing nitrous oxide canisters when they are incorrectly thrown away. Despite the ban, there are still a significant number of these canisters ending up in the household waste stream and are causing contamination at the materials recycling facility in Cossey. Estimations from the recycling facility are that it has been costing around £15,000 a month, an average of £5 a canister, to dispose of these items. A current pilot at the facility has brought down some of the costs through treating and processing canisters directly on site and sending them for recycling, and we continue to look for ways of reducing this contamination of waste. Rob Colwell, Liberal Democrat County Council for Gaywood South in King's Lynn, raised the issue at a recent council meeting. He said, I've been contacted by people concerned that they are still seeing them dumped around the countryside. One farmer contacted me and asked me to go around. I was shocked by the large number just being dumped. Laughing gas is the common name for nitrous oxide, a colourless gas frequently used as a painkiller in medicine or dentistry. Nitrous oxide is also used recreationally, where users inhale the glass for its psychoactive effects. While its chemical name is nitrous oxide, laughing gas is also known as gas and air, NOS, and hippie crack. Inhalation of the laughing gas makes the user feel lightheaded and giddy, commonly inducing fits of laughter, hence the name. It can also cause anxiety and headaches, with heavy doses known to introduce fainting. According to government research, excess use over time can lead to vitamin B12 deficiency, which causes damage to the spinal cord and nervous system. The possession of laughing gas for recreational use was made a criminal offence in November 2023. The previous Conservative government made nitrous oxide a Class C drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971 as part of a crackdown on antisocial behaviour. At the time, the government said antisocial behaviour associated with laughing gas, such as group gatherings to abuse the drug and littering of discarded canisters, was causing harm to communities. Users can receive an unlimited fine, a visible community punishment, a caution which would appear on their criminal record, or a prison sentence. But the substance is still legal to use for legitimate reasons, such as pain relief, food manufacturing, or in model rockets. Another bill for the council, for an entirely different reason. And this is an £870,000 legal bill. Lawyers were paid almost £900,000 by Norfolk County Council to fight parents in disputes over school places, new figures show. Parents appealed more than 455 decisions over placements for children with special education needs and disabilities, shortened to SEND, in 2024. The costs of such placements, providing specialist education for children who have specific needs, are placing an increasing strain on the county hall finances, prompting it to spend money resisting the demands of parents in some cases. The rising costs of SEND education and the legal fights associated with it has led leaders to ask the government to consider changing the system so that the particular circumstances of Norfolk County Council, including the huge pressure on places in special schools, are taken into account at tribunals. However, critics have branded the move deplorable, saying the proposed change is designed to increase the council's chances of winning at tribunals, even if that is not in the best interests of children. In 2024, parents lodged 455 appeals against County Hall's decisions over school placements for youngsters with special educational needs and disabilities, up on 308 the year before. In 159 of last year's cases, children were subsequently placed in special schools, while hundreds have yet to be resolved. Of 31 which ended up before judges, 23 found in favour of the children, 5 were partially dismissed or allowed, and 3 were fully dismissed. Between April and December last year, the council spent £872,000 trying to defend decisions. Appeals are often over whether the child goes to mainstream or specialist schools. The Conservative Control Council has been spending £120 million to build new specialist schools, including in Great Yarmouth, Fakenham and Easton, with plans for more. It has also created new specialist resource bases. Even though the number of funded special school places has doubled in the past decade, the council is still struggling to provide enough spaces and costs are rising. Sarah Tupp, County Hall's Director of Children's Services, recently criticised the profiteering by some private providers of specialist education. The pressure on the council is such that in March 2023, it signed a safety valve agreement with the government, getting £70 million for education services and support for Send Children up to 2029. The bailout was to cover the deficit the council accrued amid a rising number of children needing specialist provision or extra support at school and the increasing complexity of needs. As part of a submission for a revised safety valve agreement, the council has asked the Department for Education to change the law or to allow flexibility around tribunals. The council is requesting that the council's safety valve status and the council's own local first inclusion plan, its strategy for SEND transformation, can be taken into account when the tribunals consider cases. A council spokeswoman said, "We aim to provide the best placements to meet children's needs and avoid situations where families take us to tribunal. Special schools are under increasing pressure, and we must balance the needs of all the children in the school, as well as those waiting for a place. Unfortunately, the tribunal process does not consider these additional factors in its decisions. One of the ideas we are proposing, as part of the reform of the system, is for SEND tribunals to be able to consider local strategic plans as part of their decision making. This would mean they would consider what services and support is being planned in an area in addition to what is already available. Any change would require a change in the law and isn't something that we as a council could implement." Maxine Webb, independent county councillor for Norwich's Wensum division, who also has a son with special educational needs, said it was the wrong approach. She said, "Families will feel let down to see their worst fears confirmed, that Norfolk County Council chooses interfering with the law as the best solution to reducing their SEND costs and balancing their books. Taking away the rights of children to solve a decade of government underfunding is not only offensive, it does nothing to address the fundamental problem or actually help to support children. It's pretty deplorable." Penny Carpenter, Cabinet Member for Children's Services, said, "We are backing national calls for reform because the current system isn't working for children. Unfortunately, current policy makes it very difficult for schools, parents, health partners and the local authority to work together effectively, but it's only by doing that that we will improve outcomes for our children. For most children, that is mainstream education in their local communities, and this is where most of the resources should be focused. We understand the scale of change needed is going to take time, and we want to help the Department of Education to test ways of working that could improve how resources are used for our children now. The suggestions we are making are in line with recent national reviews and are very much focused on getting support to children and families earlier."
Right, more news in a while, but first, a pile of info from Vision Norfolk. Firstly, Edward is asking us to let you know that due to staff training, the Yarmouth Hub will be closed all day on the 29th of January. He says access to the phones will be limited, but if people need us, leave a message and we'll get back to them on the 30th. We'll be open as normal from that point. The second item is news of a visit to Norwich Theatre Royal. This is for a performance of Hamilton. Quite a bit of notice because this is on Friday the 3rd of October at 7:30 p.m. Hamilton is the story of America's founding father, Alexander Hamilton, an immigrant from the West Indies who became George Washington's right-hand man during the Revolutionary War and helped shape the very foundations of the America we know today. The score blends hip-hop, jazz, blues, rap, R&B and Broadway. The story of America then, as told by America now. Tickets for that are £95, including a sighted companion ticket if required. Please call Mark or Helen to book your tickets as soon as possible on 01603 573 000 extension 341 or 342 or mark.smith@visionnorfolk.org.uk. On now to the February activities. Tuesday the 4th of February is a Caister coffee morning from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. with a further Caister event on the 18th at the same time. The Yarmouth coffee mornings for February are on Wednesday the 5th, the 12th, the 19th and 26th, all from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. And Martham's coffee morning for February is on Monday the 17th, again from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. The rest of the events are at the Yarmouth Hub and are yoga classes on Wednesdays the 5th and 19th from 12:30 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. February's Fishy Friday is on the 7th from 1 until 2 p.m. Thursday the 6th sees the first of February's games mornings from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. with further events on the 13th, 20th and 27th. There's a burger and bingo event from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Tuesday the 11th. And basket weaving events for February are on Friday the 7th, 14th and 21st. Right, February's Knit, Stitch and Natter is from 1 until 3 p.m. on Thursday the 13th, with the Creative Writing Group on Friday the 14th from 1 until 3. Bowling for the month is on Tuesday the 25th, from 12 until 3 p.m. There's a seafront walk on Thursday the 27th from 1 p.m. until 3 p.m. And the last day of the month, the 28th, sees the rug workshop from 10 a.m. until 12 noon and the audio book club from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. And there's more details on that particular thing available from Mark or Helen on the Norwich number 01603 573000 extension 341. Any other queries, call Edward on 07864 61926. That's 07864 615926. Or email him at edward.bates@visionnorfolk.org.uk. Right. Cue Andy for more news, which will be followed closely by a weird Roe story.
The County Council holds talks on school violence. Education bosses have held discussions over a shock report on violence against female teachers in Norfolk schools. A survey conducted by the local branch of the National Education Union has shown that 9 out of 10 women in Norfolk schools have either experienced acts of violence in the workplace or witnessed them. It found a worrying number of teachers were considering leaving the profession. It had even sparked suggestions that they could be forced to wear body cameras in the classroom as a deterrent, with 70% of respondents saying senior leaders had shown a lack of support following incidents. Now, after the damning report was made public, education leaders at Norfolk County Council have held talks with the union on how to make the workplace safer for worried teachers. Scott Lyons, District Secretary for the union, said, We've had some really positive discussions and it feels that people are realising this is an issue. We're really keen to work with school leaders and open conversations about this, and we will be speaking with different trusts in the coming weeks. He said the union would be working alongside other education unions to put together guidance for schools on how best to support staff who are experiencing violence and other forms of abuse. He added, "Everyone we've spoken to seems really on board with finding a solution to this problem. We are getting to a stage where some people are saying they would welcome wearing cameras, which would have been unthinkable several years ago." A spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, "We meet with educations on a monthly basis to discuss employment and school-related issues." Following this union's report, it was agreed at this month's meeting that we would put some additional time aside to look at the report in detail and determine the best collective next steps. And another school's report, and this is possible Norfolk school closures. Concerns have been raised that the falling birth rate in Norfolk could lead to small schools closing, only for them to be needed again in the future. Norfolk County Council officials have warned that some schools could become unsustainable because of an all-time low of just 7,000 pupils will be entering mainstream schooling in the next 3 years. Housing growth in some parts of the county means that more than £380 million needs to be spent to build new schools and extend existing ones. But the plummeting birth rate means some smaller schools could struggle to survive. The issue was discussed at a meeting of County Hall's People and Communities Select Committee on Friday. Labour County Councillor Mike Smith-Clair raised concerns that there could be situations where schools closed only for new housing developments in the future to prompt the need for them to open again. He said, "If there are shifting sands and if schools are to close within a year, 2 years or 3 years, however long that is, with the housing growth, there might be a need for the schools. So it's the loss of a school that might be further needed down the line." Mr. Smith-Clair asked whether the council had a list of schools which it anticipated could have to close. While the council has identified areas where it could become an issue, such as Litcham, Flegg, Stalham, Reefham and parts of South and West Norfolk, officers said they did not have a specific list of planned closures. James Wilson, Director for Sufficiency Planning and Education Strategy, said, "We're very much aware that if a school closes, one of the things that can happen is that children have to travel substantial distances further away. But that's weighed against data and analysis that, in outcome terms, it's the case that in general, schools which are very small in numbers do struggle to sustain, and the impact of that is that they tend to perform less well academically. With academy schools, decisions on closures would be made by trusts and the Department for Education rather than by the council. The authority does need to build 25 new schools and expand 8 existing ones to cater for the children who will live in thousands of new homes planned for Norfolk." I don't know whether it's the season for the county council to dig up the roads, but I have a whole host of road reports here for some reason. Anyway, starting off, the replacement of the traffic lights at the Puffin Crossing in Blackburg Close Bradwell is due to begin on Monday. The work is expected to take 4 days to complete, and we'll see new equipment, including underground ducting and cabling, installed. It's part of a county-wide traffic light replacement programme, which involves updating lights where necessary to ensure they continue to meet current standards and work reliably and efficiently. And a temporary crossing will be in place during the project. A spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, "The County Council thanks people for their patience while this traffic light replacement work is carried out." And the next roadworks story, hopes that axed roundabout plans can be revived. Campaigners are hoping a scrapped multi-million pound A47 scheme can be revived in the future, despite the government pulling the plug on the project. Chancellor Rachel Reeves announced in her inaugural budget that several road projects worth a combined £1.3 billion had been axed, including a proposed upgrade to the A47 Vauxhall roundabout in Great Yarmouth. While the Chancellor's decision means a scheme first announced in 2014 will not go ahead, leaders are determined to ensure years of work to design the scheme does not go to waste. Norfolk County Council, the A47 Alliance and Transport East, a partnership of councils and business leaders across Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Southend and Thurrock, are all lobbying for the project to be revived in the future. David Cummings, Strategic Transport Manager at Norfolk County Council, said, "We're seeking urgent commitment that, although the Vauxhall scheme was pulled in the budget, it does not mean it cannot be delivered at a future date. A lot of work has gone in by National Highways to decide the scheme, and we want to see it come back, either as part of the Akle-Strait dualling or as a separate scheme beforehand." Graham Plant, the Council's Cabinet Member for Highways, said the scrapping of the scheme was disappointing. Changes to the roundabout, which would have cost up to £50 million, were originally put forward in 2017. But they were put on ice when the Herring Bridge was given the go-ahead, before the Labour government ditched the scheme. The government said the scheme was not good value for money, as it scrapped projects to help fund a £22 billion funding gap it said it had inherited from their Conservative predecessors. The roundabout would have been compatible with a dualled Akle-Strait, the 6.8-mile stretch of the A47, which is notorious for crashes. Leaders at Norfolk County Council had said the Vauxhall roundabout decision was a major setback in their long-standing ambition for the Akle-Strait dualling. And changes to Ormsby Road in Caistow have been criticised. It is hoped that a decision to tear up a busy road and revamp its layout as part of plans for a major housing estate would improve journeys through Caistow. But a year after the controversial roadworks were completed, people have complained that the new-look Ormsby Road in Caistow is worse than ever. The roadworks saw alterations made to the carriageway in the hope of calming traffic near the Persimmon Homes development of 650 homes. Among the changes to the highway were new pedestrian islands, modifications to pavement widths, and entire new roundabout built. People have criticised the layout as the pavement was extended into the middle of the old carriageway layout, creating a kink in the road rather than a circle. Kevin Wood, chairman of Caistow Parish Council, is among many who live in the village who are disappointed by the work. "The mini roundabout created is hopeless, as people just ignore it, meaning the road is more dangerous than ever, and it has no effect in slowing traffic," Mr. Wood said. "The only positive was adding another pedestrian crossing. However, they put the new crossing about 20 feet apart from the one that was already there. It's just ridiculous. They did away with the bus pull-in lanes, which has not helped anybody, and has in fact made it more difficult for people to catch buses. My feeling is that they would have been far better off putting speed cameras along the road if they want to slow people down." Mr. Wood also claimed that nobody at the parish council was consulted ahead of the work being carried out. Critics on social media claimed the changes were a massive step backwards. One user said, "Removing the lay-bys for the bus stops was a terrible idea." Another said, "The number of near accidents I've had trying to turn right at that roundabout into Webster Way is shocking and dangerous. The cars just come straight at you, forcing me to stop to avoid a collision. That roundabout is the biggest waste of money I've seen in Caister. Another added, you don't see the roundabout sign until you're near enough on it, and by then you've taken out your passenger side wheel and the hideous curved pavement. The whole road has become a chicane. Somebody else said, ridiculous place for a roundabout. Webster Way is a no-through road, so why would anybody need it? I suppose they couldn't find anywhere else to put one. The whole thing's a total waste of money, as usual. Pity they don't spend the cash on things we do want. Norfolk County Council, which is responsible for most roads in the region, said that if it did not hold a public consultation itself, and that responsibility was deferred to Great Yarmouth Borough Council. In a statement, they said these works relate to a developer-led scheme and were required as a planning condition for the Persimmon development at Jack Chase Way, Caister. They were funded by Persimmon and delivered by their contractors. Scheme plans were provided to Great Yarmouth Borough Council as local planning authority, which provided opportunity for public comment as part of the standard planning process. As with all highway works of this nature, a post-completion safety audit will be carried out and the developer will be responsible for the delivery of any changes should they be required. And my next road story? Riverside Road in Galston will be closed for 5 days next month in order to carry out ground investigation work. The road will be closed from Monday, February the 3rd to Friday, February the 7th, while Norse Laboratory carries out the works. Ahead of the work, a ground condition survey will be carried out during this week in order for Norfolk County Council to better understand ground conditions for the proposed sheet-piled retaining wall to protect the carriageway from erosion. The construction of the 150-metre sheet-piled retaining wall is planned for next year, pending permits and planning approval. The road closure will be both day and night and will have signposted diversion route. Those who need access to their property or parking during the road closure are being told to contact Norfolk County Council, which are advised that the road closure will be similar to the one carried out in December. We're back to Herring Bridge. The Herring Bridge in Great Yarmouth will be closed to traffic overnight from 8 p.m. on 4th of February to allow for routine maintenance works to be completed. A signed diversion route will be in place via Haven Bridge throughout the works. River traffic will not be affected and all vessels should continue to follow the booking procedure as normal. And the bridge will reopen by 6 a.m. on February the 5th. The A149 Caister Bypass Closure. The busy A149 Caister Bypass could be closed for 6 weeks as part of an ongoing development of 665 houses. Persimmon Homes are planning to close the northern section of the A149 Caister Bypass, also known as Jack Chase Way, from February the 24th until April the 4th. The closure would enable work installing traffic lights at the junction with Prince of Wales Road and a pedestrian crossing to the new development known as Mulberry Park. A spokesperson for Persimmon Homes said, at the request of Norfolk County Council, we've been asked to put forward options for how the Jack Chase Way signalised crossing and the traffic lights could be installed. These improvements are measures requested by residents and the local authority. One option under consideration is a short 6-week road closure that would take place outside of the holiday period when the traffic levels in Caister increases. The developer said this would avoid up to 30 weeks of roadworks and traffic management on Jack Chase Way that would likely cause much greater disruption for residents. While no decision has been taken, Persimmon has proactively engaged local businesses, schools and the parish council to understand their views on these proposals, the spokesperson added. Kevin Wood, chairman of Caister Parish Council, said, "We're not happy with it. We think it will cause chaos during rush hour in the village. It will cause gridlock." He said the last time the bypass was closed was for one day in 2019, and at that time the village was gridlocked from morning until night. The parish council has contacted the county and borough councillors for the area to express their concerns. A final decision on the proposed road closure will be made by Norfolk County Council in the coming weeks. In February last year, residents expressed frustration during the closure of Ormsby Road carriageway, also on behalf of Persimmon. And my last closure, it's Wherryman's Way. We're off the roads and onto footpaths. The future of one of Norfolk's flagship walking trails remains uncertain, as damage caused by flooding continues to hamper plans to reopen a section that's been shut for a decade. Walkers have been unable to travel the full length of the original Wherryman's Way route since 2015, after two bridges at Hardy Flood near Loddon were shut after becoming eroded. It has meant hikers have faced lengthy diversions and also been unable to pass through the 123-acre nature reserve via the banks of the River Chet. But the project has since stalled after it was discovered that frequent flooding has caused more damage than first thought, with two further bridges deteriorating rapidly and banks being eroded, rendering them unsafe. Long-term solutions are now being sought, according to Norfolk County Council, which is responsible for maintaining the Wherryman's Way. Locals fear one option may be to not reopen the section. A spokesman said, "Sections of the Wherryman's Way have been closed for some time, as there has been significant and ongoing erosion to the banks, which carry the public rights of way. Further viable solutions along the route are being investigated with the relevant statutory bodies, and we are currently updating our plans to reflect the changing conditions to the natural environment. Costings and options are currently being developed, and any proposals will be communicated locally once they're confirmed." The fate of this section of Wherryman's Way comes amid fears that climate change and rising water levels could threaten hundreds of miles of footpaths in the Broad. Since 2020, 10 paths have been rerouted further inland away from riverbanks, meaning some trails no longer allow walkers to follow the course of some of Norfolk's idyllic waterways. Broads Authority officials have warned this will likely be a growing trend, as riverside paths do not have legal protections that require them to be rerouted along the route of a river. And another sort of closure now. The Lloyds Bank in the High Street in Gorleston closed its doors for the last time last Monday, January the 20th. A spokeswoman for the bank confirmed that the branch has closed as visits have fallen over recent years. She added, "As many customers now choose to bank through their app or online, visits to our Gorleston-on-Sea branch have fallen over recent years. Customers can continue to manage their money either online, by calling us, in person at our Great Yarmouth branch, or at the local post office on the High Street. The nearby post office, which is just a 1 minute walk away from the now closed Lloyds Bank, allows customers to access their cash and pay in cheques. The nearest free to use ATM is a tenth of a mile away from the branch, and there's a total of three other free to use ATMs within half a mile of the site." I now have a series of housing stories of various descriptions. The first one is in Martham. A developer has failed in a battle to build 44 homes in Martham Village after government officials intervened and blocked the proposals. Bennett Homes hoped to construct the project on land off Somerton Road in the village, which would have involved demolishing agricultural buildings to make way for the new properties. However, due to delays in making a decision on the application by Great Yarmouth Borough Council, the firm appealed to the Planning Inspectorate, the government department that presides over planning disputes. It said that the council had failed to process the application efficiently due to a lack of resources and called on the inspectorate to decide the outcome instead. With the appeal ongoing, the council's planning committee voted to reject the building anyway, due to a wide range of reasons, including poor design, a lack of identity, an unfortunate approach to the affordable housing design, and a lack of information about its flood risk management. This decision helped inform the planning inspector's judgment of the scheme. The official said the development would not harm the character of the area and acknowledged it would bring economic and social benefits. However, it was ultimately refused due to the potential damage it could have on protected trees, bats and amphibians in the village. This included the great crested newt, a species that can often scupper the plans of developers. Inspector Philip Milam said, "Overall, the proposal's benefits, along with the other considerations advanced, would not be sufficient to outweigh the harm identified in respect of trees or protected species." While these 44 homes will not be built, Martham is set to undergo a major expansion of its population, with it growing by about 20% through more than 240 other homes being built. Villagers have been wary of the new homes, worrying the local services such as doctor surgeries and schools will struggle to cope with the growing population. Now I have another in the Weird Norfolk series, and it concerns Glasshouse Row in Yarmouth. It was like a haunted house in Ghost Story. Broken down, rat-infested, empty, forbidding, and filled with dark secrets, hatred and fury. The old house, ancient even in 1797, was on Glasshouse Row in Great Yarmouth. One of the warren of 145 narrow walkways that lined the town for centuries. Running from North Quay to George Street, Glasshouse Row was named for the glass factory in the Runnel, which, according to an advertisement in the Norwich Mercury, produced the best goods of all sorts which can be obtained at reasonable prices. Lord Nelson was presented with two pieces from the Glasshouse Row Works on his visit to Yarmouth in 1805, and production continued there for 200 years. The row also boasted a school and a terrifying murder house. Passers-by would quicken their step to avoid spending too long near the windowless house in case someone or something reached from inside to pull them into a dark, dank room. In the Yarmouth Independent of January the 6th and 13th in 1894, there was a two-part article, Tales and Traditions of Old Yarmouth, a House of Mystery. It concerned the haunted house of Row 37, itself unremarkable and similar to many other rows, said the Independent. Most possessed of the same quaint, gloomy and somewhat dingy characteristics in common. In the middle of the row stood the unloved old house, with its peeling paint, rodent terrace, and terrifying reputation as the house where a terrible murder had taken place. Some said the ghost was the murderer, wandering from room to room, others that it was their victim, bound to earth until justice was done, while more said the haunting was the grim tragedy being replayed over and over again where it had happened. When the owner of the building died, It was left to a relative who had heard about the reputation of his legacy and swiftly tried to sell it and bid it goodbye forever. He was not besieged with offers. But finally, a middle-aged man called David Brown offered to take the house, offering a pittance in return. The owner haggled, but finally agreed to sell the house for an extremely low price. Brown had the house repaired and moved his family in. His wife, his 12-year-old daughter, and his ageing mother. Having moved in, the Brown family were delighted with their new home. A bargain it had been, and in such a convenient location, close to both the river and the town. But their joy was premature. Within 2 months, doors in the house began to slam, and the Browns set out to deal with the drafts they believed were causing the disturbances. Lantern, the quarterly periodical of the Borderline Science Investigation Group, which operated in 1971 and 1982 and was based in Lowestoft, takes up the story. Instead of curtailing the occurrences, however, these precautions had the opposite effect. Now, instead of the doors slamming occasionally as before, they slam more frequently, often many times in quick succession. This was not all. Sometimes the tramp of heavy feet was now heard ascending the stairs, followed by the heavy thud of something hitting the floor overhead. On other occasions, light, hesitant footsteps would be heard stealthily pattering around the house, accompanied by a soft rustling noise like that of a long silk dress. The door of the room in which the family were sitting would be thrown open, and some invisible presence would enter, walk around the room, pause for a few seconds, and then depart, leaving behind an air of gloom and creepiness. As you might expect, the family were terrified, although proud Mr. Brown refused to openly admit that anything strange was happening. Privately, however, he decided to visit a local wise woman, Nancy Green. She told him she couldn't help, and he called her a charlatan, at which point she told him that when he arrived home, he would find one of his family dead. Rushing back to Glasshouse Row, he was horrified to find his wife in tears on the doorstep. She told him that Mr. Brown Sr., David's mother, had indeed just dropped dead. The house went quiet again for 5 months. Then the disturbances began again. One night the household was awakened by a piercing scream and muffled thuds above them. Brown and his wife sat up in bed, and there, by their bedside, was a tall, thin old man wearing a white nightshirt and a red flannel nightcap. He stared at them before turning slowly, sighing, and then disappearing at the door. The silence returned, and then, as before, there were screams and loud crashes. On the third occasion this happened, Brown rose quietly and went to the room where the noise was at its loudest. He opened the door, his lamplight illuminating the room. Every piece of furniture had been thrown into one corner other than the bed. And on the bed sat a wizened old lady wearing a black silk dress. She paid no attention to Brown. Instead, she was staring at cards laid out on the counterpane. She rearranged the cards again and again, muttering to herself as she did so, before giving a low chuckle, rising and gliding to the end of the room, where she disappeared in front of Brown's eyes. The decision was made to leave the house. As the family packed ahead of their move one evening, the daughter went upstairs to search for something for her mother. In the upper rooms, she was amazed to find a pure white lamb standing in the middle of one room,
looking intently at her. She walked towards it, enchanted, and it began to trot between rooms and finally to the top of the stairs. Realising it was no longer frightened of her, the girl reached out her hand to pet it. But just as her fingertips grazed the soft wool, the animal uttered a chilling growl, and she was lifted bodily from the floor and flung down the stairs. Her parents tended their unconscious child. It was hours before she came round and was able to tell them exactly what had happened. The family left immediately, never to return. But there was one more throw of dice for the house, one more score to settle. Hearing the house was empty, Nancy Green contacted Mr. Brown and asked if she could move in, possibly for a small rent, but equally perhaps just to keep the house occupied. Realising no one else would risk staying at the house filled with restless, vengeful spirits, he agreed, and Nancy moved in, selling her spells, cures and potions from Glasshouse Row. But her good fortune at finding a large house for a peppercorn rent was short-lived. Hardly a month after she moved in, she was found by neighbours, lying dead in the house, her face contorted into a dreadful mask of terror. She had, it seems, met the other tenants. After Nancy's death, the house really did fall silent, until the bombing raids of the 1940s and the council's slum clearance programme swept away the vast majority of their rows, taking homes and livelihoods, communities and poltergeist with them, hopefully in the case of the latter. Lantern noted in 1974, "Today, very little remains of Glasshouse Row, certainly not that portion in which the house stood. The original entrance on North Quay is still there, as is the first 50 foot or so of the row, still probably more or less as it was when this story took place. The larger proportion, running westwards from George Street, has now completely gone, although the path of the row followed exactly the line of the footpath at the rear of the houses in Coronation Terrace. The rest of the row has now gone altogether. In fact, a block of modern flats extends across its original path at one point."
Too bad.
Shaken Stevens and This Old House. OK, time to get you completely up to date with the rest of this week's local news.
A coach house and outbuildings in Reedham Village could be converted into housing. Bernard Brett has submitted a planning application to Broadland District Council for buildings at Reedham Old Hall on Church Road. The proposal would see the coach house and outbuildings, which are disused, transformed into two houses. Reedham Parish Council is supporting the development, but is concerned about traffic management during the construction phase. In a letter to Broadland Council, the Parish Council noted the emergency access to nearby Joseph House care home, which caters for residents who are elderly or have learning disabilities. Emergency vehicles are frequently called to the care home, and a clear route through must be ensured at all times, it said. Elsewhere in Reedham, there are plans to knock down the former Gospel Hall, also to make way for housing. The proposal would see the 19th century building, described as an eyesore after not being used for several years, demolished and replaced with a three-bedroom home. A village pub, taken over by new management only last summer, has closed. The Farmers, previously known as the Jolly Farmers in Ormsby St Margaret, ceased trading on New Year's Eve. Stonegate Group, which owns the venue, confirmed they are recruiting for a new publican to run the business. It is the latest in a string of establishments owned by the same company to close in the area over the last few months. In August, the Sun Hill on Beckles Road in Bradwell announced it was closing. The following month, the King's Arms in Caister shut down, with the landlords blaming astronomical costs charged by the venue's owners. Last month saw the landlady of the King's Head in Belton call time, only 2 months after taking over the premises. In the wake of the latest closure, Ormsby St Margaret with Scrapby Parish Council discussed the fate of the Farmers at a meeting on January the 13th. The council agreed the venue was a valued asset for the village and said they would consider applying to make it an asset of community value at next month's meeting. The Farmers was taken over by former staff members Harry Daisley and Tallulah Camphor Wood last June. Previously, the pub closed in April. The pub had a £150,000 revamp in November 2021, which saw it fitted out with a new kitchen and new toilets, and which included the name change. The pub scene in the area has seen a wave of changes over the last couple of years, marked by closures, reopenings and ownership shifts. Last week, the landlords of the Lion Pub near Great Yarmouth Seafront announced they were planning to retire, with the pub put up for sale. In Somerton, another venue, also called the Lion, is on the market as villagers try and raise enough money to make an offer on the property. Further afield, yet another Stonegate pub, the Bear and Bells in Old Market in Beckles, closed earlier this month. And again, a local take on a story that keeps popping up in the national news, sewage spills. Water company bosses have revealed the number of sewage spills into Norfolk rivers and seas increased last year, despite a pledge to reduce them. Anglian Water representatives presented data to Norfolk County councillors showing there were 4,337 such spills between January and October last year, up from 3,701 for the whole of 2023. The spills come from the sewerage and drainage network, when excess, untreated water is released directly into the county's rivers or the sea. Water company bosses have revealed the number of sewage spills into Norfolk rivers and seas increased last year, despite the pledge to reduce them. They're only supposed to be used in exceptional circumstances, such as periods of unusually heavy rain, to prevent the system backing up and flooding people's homes and businesses with sewage. Permits issued by the Environment Agency allow them to be used at certain times, but water companies have been criticised and fined for breaking the law by using them on other occasions. Anglian water officers, who appeared before County Council's Scrutiny Committee to discuss the spills on Wednesday, January the 22nd, said the latest figures came on the back of two of the wettest years on record. They also said the figures, still provisional at this stage, cover the first year of monitoring being in place on all 174 of Norfolk's combined sewer overflows. Anglian Water has submitted a storm overflow action plan to the government, which contains a detailed improvement plan for each overflow to ensure they're not discharging more than 10 times a year by 2050. But the latest figures show that each one in Norfolk was discharged on an average of 25 times in 2024. The highest number of spills were northwest Norfolk, with 856 pollution incidents. Southwest Norfolk saw 650, and South Norfolk had 638. Locally, there were 352 in Great Yarmouth and 268 in Broadland. Stephen Morphew, leader of the Labour group at County Hall, said, "I appreciate the data has not been fully verified, but from the point of view of the people we represent, this means that in the real world, the spills are not going down. I understand why, perhaps because of the wettest year on record, but it still means there are storm overflows, which are unacceptable in most people's minds. I'm not surprised the numbers have gone up with the new monitors, because we were assuming the true numbers were much higher than we were seeing because they weren't being monitored." Gail Pickles, Anglian Water's head of spill reduction, said, "We absolutely know there is much to do. We share the same ambition in bringing the spill numbers down." And another sewage story. Caister's Pong, still a mystery. It has plagued the seaside village for more than a decade, but the source of Caister-on-Sea's notorious Pong remains elusive after it returned with a vengeance in recent months. Anglian Water engineers have insisted its sewage treatment plant, which has been blamed for the problem, is operating within safe limits for odours following multi-million pound improvements. The water firm has invested huge sums into improving Caister Water Recycling Centre, which serves thousands of homes in the area, as part of a £5.9 million scheme to boost the sewage network in Yarmouth Borough. The facility processes sewage from properties in Great Yarmouth, as well as the northern villages like Ormsby, Hemsby and Scrapby. 5 years ago, the situation became intolerable for some villagers who made records in stench diaries and were forced to keep windows and doors shut. It even led Great Yarmouth Borough Council to issue an enforcement notice to Anglian Water after officers declared it a statutory nuisance to villagers. New odour-suppressing filters and monitoring equipment have improved the situation. However, problems persist for villagers, who continue to complain their lives are being affected by a foul stench that has periodically reappeared. It is the southern end of the village that's worse affected, near where the sewage treatment plant is located. But engineers think there may be other sources at play. At a Borough Council Scrutiny Committee meeting, Anglian Water officials faced a grilling for councillors about the problem. Last year, officers received two complaints about the smell over the summer, and villagers have also reported it returning shortly before Christmas. Donna Hammond, a councillor who lives in Caister, said, "The smell has been there forever in Caister. When I have noticed it, it's really offensive. Will anything be done to improve it?" She said it appears to form in pockets in parts of the town, mostly near the village bypass. In December last year, it lingered for several days, with Miss Hammond saying she spoke with several people complaining about the disgusting pong. But Mervyn Ward, Water Recycling's operations manager, said identifying the source had become a mystery. He said when they receive complaints, they'll look at the weather systems to identify the wind direction. During the pre-Christmas stink, Mr. Ward said it was blowing in the other direction to where the smell was reported by villagers, close to the Tesco store in Yarmouth Road. He added, the airflow was going the other way to the pong. These are things we're working to try and understand. The levels of sulphides we have recorded are within statutory limits. There's some understanding that it may not be coming from us. We think we're doing everything right, but obviously something isn't working. Mr. Ward said Anglian Water is looking at using new technology to reduce odours and stop the nuisance to local residents. He also called on visitors to get in touch when they notice the pong, so engineers can develop a clearer picture of when and where it appears. Grant Tufts, Regional Engagement Manager for Anglian Water, said more investment in the facility will hopefully see the end of the pong in future years. It has committed to spending £75.7 million in the Yarmouth District over the next 5 years to help improve its services. However, Kevin Wood, chairman of Caister Parish Council, said villagers are still pinching their noses and are not holding their breath in the hope it will be solved any time soon. Following the meeting, he said he was surprised to hear that Anglian Water did not understand where the pong had appeared last month had appeared from. This has gone on for so long and it's still a problem, he said. It left people unable to open their windows last summer. We're very disappointed with Anglian Water about how they've handled the whole thing. There are plans to build hundreds of new homes in the northern villages, and we've concerns it could make the problem worse. They've been promising it will stop for so many years, but it's still there. And getting away from those horrible stories, Britannia Pier has a sign up for sale. The letters that spell the name of a famous seafront landmark are up for sale. The owners of Britannia Pier are selling their iconic sign after it was taken down as part of the £1.8 million transformation of the venue. In November, demolition teams began tearing down an old building on the site to make way for a new indoor entertainment centre. The tall neon letters that sat on top of the entrance were removed just before Christmas. Illuminated bright orange after sunset, they were a familiar sight to locals and holidaymakers, and for many they were part of childhood memories. Originally, the pier owners wanted to keep the sign, restore it and place it elsewhere on the site. But Cherise Abbott, pier director, said, "When the builders took it down, it was in a very bad state. The cost of restoring it would have well exceeded buying anything brand new. It's in a bit of a bad way, so there's not much we can do with it. And we've had inquiries in the past if any parts would be put up for sale, so that's what we've decided to do." People interested in buying the sign, or any of its individual letters, can contact the pier via their Facebook page. Meanwhile, the revamp of the venue has been going okay. Ms. Abbott said, "We did get battered a little bit with the storms before Christmas, so that set work back a bit, but all the demolition is done, all the old parts are gone to make way for the new build. The building work has started now, and we're on track to open for Easter. Meanwhile, the existing arcade, fish and chip shop, rides and bar remain open." And at last, a little bit of good news? I don't know. Yarmouth Cleaning Company has won the racecourse contract. It began with an episode of Come Dine With Me. 4 years ago, Maxwell Harrison was at home watching the show. Part of the episode had one of the contestants cleaning an oven, he says. "I saw that. I thought, I'll give it a go at my dad's house." Inspired, Mr. Harrison put on a pair of rubber gloves and, armed with a spatula, spray bottle and microfiber cloth, he set about scrubbing the oven. His dad was quite happy with the job, and soon, through word of mouth, other family members and then neighbours were asking him to clean their ovens. One person spoke to another. It grew quite rapidly, Mr. Harrison, who went to Lingrove School in Gorleston, says. At the time, he was an estate agent, and the oven cleaning began to take over his weekends, becoming a side job. It was during one of his appointments, while cleaning an oven at a holiday home, he was asked to clean the whole house after the cleaning company had failed to turn up. At that point, Mr. Harrison convinced his mother Angela to leave her job and come and work with him. No longer cleaning only ovens, they now had contracts for holiday lets, offices and apartments, then restaurants and cafes. The company, called MCI Cleaning Services, now employs 22 people. In November last year, Mr. Harrison, 26, left his job as an estate agent to concentrate full-time on his own business. Most recently, the company has won the contract for cleaning Great Yarmouth Racecourse. Mr. Harrison said, I was always inspired by a gentleman called Steve Pym, who owns Pym & Co. Estate Agents. He inspired me when I worked for him. He was a really good motivator to succeed, to make something your own. And this last story is a bit of a long one, but again, it's a local take on stories that keep hitting the national news. And it's how business is harnessing AI technology. From driverless tractors to developing disease-resistant crops for farmers, businesses in the East are harnessing the power of artificial intelligence, which is of course AI, in some very exciting ways. The government revealed plans last week to unleash AI across the UK in a bid to drive growth and deliver public services, including the NHS, more efficiently. The nation's AI revolution will see £14 billion invested in new data centres, the vast infrastructure facilities needed to power AI, with plans to build a supercomputer to increase the UK's computing power 20-fold by 2030. While there are concerns that AI will replace jobs, the Prime Minister has promised 13,250 AI-related posts are set to be created. And firms in the East are already leading the way when it comes to AI. Almost three quarters of private businesses in the region are preparing to invest in technologies like AI this year, which is the highest proportion in any region across the country, according to business accountants KPMG UK. TraitSec, based at Norwich Research Park, uses machine learning, which is a process by which a computer can come to make predictions or decisions without explicit programming. It uses those and AI algorithms to analyse biological data sets that are too complex for humans to interpret. The team uses the results to help companies specialise in agritech, the application of technology to make farming more efficient, develop products for farmers. We start with a data set that has potentially tens of thousands of genes, and our mission is to find the genes that link with a particular trait that a company is interested in, said Dr. Joshua Colmer, TraitSec's CEO and co-founder. For example, a gene editing company might want to develop a disease-resistant line of wheat. We would work with them to identify which genes are linked with that disease-resistant trait so that they make the edit, or work with them to build a model that they can use to predict how well an edited version could perform in the field. By using AI, TraitSec is reducing variable performance when testing products between a controlled environment and the field, which is currently a serious problem for the industry. Things can look very promising in the glasshouse, only to perform significantly worse in the field, said Dr. Colmer. So we're working on empowering companies with AI-based tools they can use to predict how a product's performance might vary between the glasshouse and the field, reducing trial and error testing and increasing success rates. We're accelerating the development processes for companies that supply our farmers with what they need to grow their crops. If we can make the development process shorter, farmers will get high quality and effective products faster. TraitSec recently announced a partnership with global agritech company Syngenta. The collaboration aims to help farmers transition to more sustainable crop protection practices by using AI to develop innovative, high-performance biostimulants which boost the natural plant processes. Home Farm in Ipswich is using driverless tractors powered by AI to phase out back-breaking hand weeding. Since 2021, the farmers has been using Roboti, an autonomous agricultural robot which uses AI to identify crops in the field and eliminate unwanted plants. It has also been using solar-powered farm droids, seeding and weeding robots, on the 1,170-hectare operation at the Orwell Park estate since 2022. The firm first considered automation after losing five key workers due to retirement, one of whom had managed hoeing and weeding control for many years. Craig Bird, a former Microsoft employee, and James Grant, who worked at multinational accounting network firm RSM for 16 years, co-founded AI consultancy firm IWantMore.ai last year to help introduce small or medium-sized businesses in East Anglia to AI. The firm is working with companies across the region, currently in towns such as Ipswich, Diss and Cambridge, to identify areas where AI could improve productivity and efficiency. We see a massive opportunity for AI and automation in small and medium-sized businesses, said Mr. Grant from Bury. There's a lack of knowledge and understanding about what AI is and what it can do, which we try and demystify for businesses. They don't need to spend millions of pounds. There are things most businesses can do without huge amounts of money. The use of AI is only limited by your imagination. The things that you can do with it, a lot of people would never have even thought of. They said shadow AI, the unsanctioned use of the technology, is already taking place in most workplaces. Tools are being used behind the scenes in businesses by employees because they've seen the benefits of things like ChatGPT in their home life, but it's not yet approved or under the IT security umbrella of the companies they work for, Mr. Grant added. The use of AI is only going to increase over time as businesses see more use cases for it. Well, there you go. AI. Perhaps there ought to be a questionnaire after a long report by that. However, that was my last news item.
That's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2025 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Your newsreader next week will be Desney, so we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all of us here at Grapevine, stay safe and well and hopefully free from any more storms. And bye for now.